I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Mary Roach has visited the Body Farm in Tennessee to observe rotting cadavers. She's ridden NASA's Vomit Comet and volunteered to do MRI coital imaging with her husband, all, of course, for research. She's used her curiosity and passion to explore the icky and fascinating parts of science for her best-selling books that include Gulp, Packing for Mars, Bonk, Spook, and Stiff. Her new book, Grunt, is about the science of war, or more specifically, what researchers are doing to protect soldiers and Marines from heat stroke, panic, exhaustion, shock, diarrhea. She learns why snipers don't like zippers, how to make a stink bomb, why the VA spends $1 billion a year on disability payments for hearing loss, how medics are prepared for battlefield injuries, and why maggots are excellent healers. Mary Roach joins us once again on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Reading through this book, and you've been on the show, I think, for all of your other books, this is a trickier thing for a Mary Roach treatment, if you know what I mean. You have a humorous and a kind of a breezy approach to much of what you have written about, and you've used yourself as kind of part of the story as well. Mm-hmm. But this is about war. This is about people killing and being killed.
Yeah.
Being hurt and being injured.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so the tone of the book was a bit of a challenge for me because I know that I'm writing for Mary Roach readers who expect Mary Roach to be Mary Roach, but I'm also writing for people who may have served in the military, may have experienced these things that I'm writing about in a way that I never have. Yeah. So it's not really mine to play around with. So the humor is more directed at me, or some of the historical chapters or the footnotes. It definitely it's a little more careful.
I was just going to say careful. And I have to say, even reading through it, it was a reminder for me about how much time we have spent at war. I mean, obviously, the kind of investment that we have made in war, building bombs and things like that. But then the other side of this, which is the investment we've made as a country to try to protect soldiers and Marines from actual warfare.
Right, right. And things that you don't necessarily think about. I mean, you think about combat casualty care, medevacs, and keeping people from bleeding to death, and you know, the emergency stuff that everybody sees in films, but yeah. Then kind of the background misery of heat and back pain and sleep loss. And you know, I'm on a book tour, and I complain about it. I get up at 5 a.m. and I'm like, just shut up. You know, are you walking around? Do you feel okay? Then stop complaining.
It's interesting you say that, because I was thinking about, you know, what it must be like to be sleeping in the middle of a war, which of course is impossible. We worry about, you know, truck drivers not getting enough sleep because of safety issues. And I'm thinking about these soldiers, Marines that are getting catnaps here and there, and the effect that it has on their ability to do their job, and also just their emotional state.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I spent time on a ballistic missile submarine, and the science I was reporting on was a new watch bill. They were trying to, because for a long time, in order to keep somebody watching, if you're on a ballistic missile submarine, it's nuclear, it's got nuclear bombs on it, but it's also nuclear powered, so it can stay under, doesn't have to go refuel or stock up, so it can stay hidden. So you have this situation where you need people up all the time watching it. So how do you get, let people sleep, but also, yeah, you know, have the posts filled all the time? And what they were doing for many years was changing the length of the day. So in essence, messing with circadian rhythm. So not only were people sleep deprived and overworked, plus they're studying for their qualification, so they're just flat out busy. But now it's like flying to Paris every day.
Wow, yeah. Wow.
Minus the Paris part.
I mean, yeah, dealing with this nuclear powered,
right, right.
Vessel.
So you know that obviously that's a situation. This is a roving nuclear arsenal. You don't really want people asleep on the job. Yeah.
What got you interested in this, in a sense, the science of not just warfare, but also how to protect soldiers?
Yeah, kind of an odd path to the book. I was reporting in India on the world's hottest chili pepper, the Bhut Jalokia, and arguably, there are people who say it's not. Anyway, a very, very hot chili pepper. There's a chili pepper eating contest, et cetera, and while I was there, I was told that the Indian Defense Ministry, the science arm, had created a non-lethal weapon using this chili pepper. So I went over to the neighboring state and I said, hello, I'd like to talk to you about your essentially a tear gas that they had made, tear powder. And while I was there, just nosing around and talking to people in the malaria unit, there was a project. They were developing a leech repellent and going out into the river and rolling up their trousers and testing this leech repellent. I thought, well, that's all very Mary Roach and interesting.
It's very Mary Roach and interesting.
And it occurred to me that military science is a broader and more esoteric undertaking. It incorporates a lot of fields of science all at once. It's not just medicine. I mean, you think about emergency care and medicine, and that's part of the book as well. But just a lot of enabling me to just sort of stick a toe into like bioengineering and leech.
And leeches.
But although the leeches didn't make the cut.
I mean, warfare is about using things like leeches and stink bombs and, you know, very sort of basic stuff. And it's also Stuxnet and using, you know, computer viruses in order to take down another country or another company.
Right, sure, yeah. I mean, because the human body is my bag, I stuck to more the science that dealt with the everyday grind of and dangers of being in combat. And I thought that it was also because we all deal in one way or another with heat and loud noise and stress and fear, and I thought, you know, people could relate on that level as well, even if they're not in the military or haven't had that experience.
Sure. Well, certainly the issue of heat in places like Iraq, where my understanding in the summer the temperatures can be something like 120 mm-hmm. degrees, mm-hmm. and you've got soldiers, Marines wearing vests and Kevlar and carrying things around. How do they deal with that?
Well, they need to hydrate, but and what happens, and I didn't really have an understanding of heat injury and how that works, and it sets up this intense competition in the body for the fluids, and it's when you sweat, it comes from your plasma, the clear portion of the blood. Your body's, you know, the capillaries in the skin dilate, and you get more blood going there, offloading the heat as vapor, so cooling you down that way. The heat goes off into the air, but if you're working hard, your muscles want that blood as well. So there's this competition. At a certain point, somebody's going to lose out. When you have heat strokes, sometimes like the gut will shut down, you know, or you may not make it to the brain. You may faint. You know, that's less dangerous than heat stroke. But anyway, it's this. And as you said, you're working hard. You have this pack. You have this hot gear. And so the military, the USIS, the medical school, uniform services, University of Health Sciences, was looking at they were doing a project while I was there. They have something called a cook box, casually, where you can create this scenario. There are treadmills, and you can put on gear. And when I was there, it was 100 degrees. There were a couple of Army Rangers who were handling it quite well. I was not. But the point of it was, is there some way to, either through genetics or blood marker, some way to identify people who are constitutionally not able to acclimate and who are really hit hard. And if you could, then you could keep those people out of that extreme heat situation, because they're the ones that are going to come down with heat stroke. But it's tough, because even the ones that do well, because they can take the heat, they tend to get given the harder assignment. So, you know, they end up overexerting and getting hit with that. So it's tough to make it all work out. But that was the hope, that you could identify people, because you do acclimate. I mean, it's amazing.
You felt that as well?
You do. Well, no, it takes a couple of days. Right. And when I was in there, I saw these guys. They started to sweat right away. And I thought, I'm not sweating here. I'm doing okay. But in fact, that's because their body's like, okay, it's hot, let's cool you down. Whereas my body was like, ooh, is there something going on here? Is it hot in here? I'd like to have a popsicle.
That's what your body sounds like?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of, ooh, ooh, ooh. So, and I wasn't sweating, so I got flushed, and I had to stop with the pack on 7 minutes.
Wow.
That's not much of a march.
No, and heavy. How heavy was the pack?
And mine was only 30 pounds.
And 30 pounds.
Not
95 pounds? Some of these.
Yes. When body armor itself can be 30 something pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. And that, you know, you're carrying that. You're not just wearing it, you're carrying it.
one of the people said that, I don't know if this was scientific or just people trying to figure out, so how do I hydrate under these circumstances, which was to pre-hydrate, which was to drink just tons of water before going out into this.
That was an interesting, that it's called pre-drinking. And there was a guy, Dr. Adolf, who looked into that some decades back, where he said, you know, you could use the body as a secondary storage tank and just tank up. And there was an argument that, you know, you would just pee it out. So he actually had, he puts people, I'm not sure who his volunteers were, but he put them on a dehydration hike. And had them pre-drink, found that they only peed out, I think it was around 15%, 15 to 25%. So the rest of that water was available to sweat. So, however, you know, pre-drinking is not a recommended approach in the military. So I don't know if Dr. Adolf's work has been found to be lacking in some way, but that's what he found. And I'm a pre-drinker.
You did find, I think there was some military manual, 422 pages on sweat.
Yes, exactly.
What does that tell us about the military?
That book was amazing. Dr. Yas Kuno, a Japanese physiologist, and he had this amazing these photographs of these people. He put this starch on them that would turn black when you sweat. And then he took photographs of the patterns of sweat and individual differences and where people sweat. And they kind of look like they've broken out in some virulent mildew.
Wow.
These little black specks all over
them.
Just a fascinating. And he talked about, you know, when we look at where mankind has gone in the world, the reason we've been able to settle the equatorial regions is because of our sweat gland, that we are able to cool ourselves down and other organisms can't. So we've been able to travel the globe. And he really was like, civilization owes itself to the sweat gland.
And these are the kinds of people that you meet when doing books like this, right?
Exactly. People are so
single-minded
dialed down.
And passionate.
Yeah. And he spent, I was like, 30 years studying perspiration and the thermoregulatory system, not just sweat, but the whole system. And I love people like him. I mean, he's no longer with us, but I spoke to other.
I mean, this is what you look for when you write a Mary Roach book, yes?
Yeah. Someone who, like for Gulp, my last book, just finding this beautiful Italian woman who studied saliva. And who was passionate about saliva and what an amazing substance it is and how little respect it gets. And the same with Yas Kuno. He was just, he said, there are people who, you know, unless they can't sweat and then they know how important it is, people don't like sweat. He was kind of personally offended.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Mary Roach is our guest. We believe that she has been on our show talking about every single one of the books that she's written. Her new one is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Mary Roach about her new book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And again, you can join us by calling 1-888-477-9499. Well, you already talked about pee, about urine, so it's time to talk about dysentery, diarrhea. But when you think about it, how important that is in order to manage it, understand it for people at war.
Right. There were conflicts, not so much now, but historically. I mean, the Mexican-American War, seven cases of dysentery or malaria, you know, disease killed or inflicted itself on seven. The ratio was 7-1, disease to combat.
Right, so, 7-1.
Yeah, 7-1. William Osler, the father of modern medicine, had that great quote, dysentery has been more fatal to soldiers than powder or shot.
Wow.
So, and now diarrhea is, dysentery, and dysentery is an extreme form of diarrhea where pathogens infect the lining of the intestine and you have bloody stools. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah. But, it's Mary Roach. What can we say?
Sorry. But today you have WHO released a statistic, and it was last year, 2.4 or 2.2 million deaths per year. A lot of, in developing nations, a lot of children dehydrating and dying from diarrhea. So, and now though, I mean, what I, in Grunt, I ended up spending time with some special operations personnel in Djibouti, which is, there's a lot of counterinsurgency work that goes on there. It's right near Somalia and Yemen. And special operations teams, they go out in very small groups and they are doing, you know, kind of classified, high risk, intense missions. And because they are spending time in remote areas, they're not on the big base where the hygiene is excellent. They're out in a village eating not necessarily clean water, not food that may not have been refrigerated, and the rates of diarrhea are twice as high in that population. With the, and the average, there was a diarrhea, a study in that was done in, I think, 2003 or 4 in Iraq, and 77% of personnel had had diarrhea, 40% serious enough to go seek medical treatment, and 32% to the extent where they couldn't make it to a restroom on time. And that's, you know, I talked to these special operations guys, and I had to do this. It was an awkward reporting situation because these guys are in a restricted zone, they off to themselves. They come out to eat because they don't have their own dining facility. So,
right.
And they're easy to identify because they have big beards and everybody else is clean shaven. So I'd have to kind of march up to this big, stony, scary, bearded guy and say, oh, hello, you don't know me. I'd like to talk about diarrhea. I know it sounds like a silly topic. And this one guy just looked at me and said, It's not. Sit down.
Yeah. I mean, this is reality in many ways. And I would think whether contaminated food or you mentioned water, stress. I mean, there's so many reasons that this could be
right.
a problem.
Right. So I was there with a diarrhea researcher, Captain Mark Riddle, who said in a moment of passion about his topic, "I live and breathe this stuff." It's just not intending. That's a quote. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
But you're very passionate about his work. And he was talking about there are post-infectious consequences. You can have a bout of severe food poisoning and then find yourself with irritable bowel syndrome. And so there's a form of arthritis called reactive arthritis. And these are getting to be big issues in terms of the VA having to pay for medical care for the consequences of bad cases of food poisoning. Anyway, he was looking at a treatment regimen that would, you know, single dose, where you could knock it out quite quickly. So that's what he was doing there. And I think that would be a very welcome addition to the arsenal.
Well, while we're on the subject, you also went to this Natick Labs where they're testing clothing materials for soldiers, for Marines to wear, including something called self-cleaning underwear.
Yeah, self-cleaning.
How far did they get with that?
Yeah, the self-cleaning underwear is kind of the way the public affairs guy reeled me in. He's like, Mary Roach, how can we get her cover.
Bingo.
In fact, it's a self-cleaning fabric. The main application, though, is in the case of chemical warfare. It's a super shedding fabric. It's treated so that most things just roll off. I mean, depending on what you spill on yourself or have thrown at you, some stuff will roll off, and other things like aviation fuel or alcohol will soak right in. So they're looking for a fabric where everything will bead up and roll off, and so there's ways to do that. And so it's a super shedding, self-cleaning fabric. There are not actually underwear. Well, there may be like long underwear, but anyway, it was a ChemBio suit that they were testing, and it was amazing. They put on a roll board and just for the purposes of demonstration, just squirted some mustard, which just held its form and rolled off, just completely rolled off. Anyway, it's kind of a cool technology.
Well, I'm thinking about those people in 120 degrees. Is this breathable fabric? Because
it has to be. This is the thing with any military uniform. It's going to have to perform a lot of roles. It's got to wear a lot of hats, which is an odd thing to say about a uniform. But it's got to be. You want it to be itself. If super shedding, that'd be great. Flame resistant is really important. You want it to have a insect, you know, mosquito repellent treatment, and all of these things have to play together well. They have to work together, so it's a chemistry challenge, and then it also has to be breathable. I mean,
sure.
There's certain fabrics that work really well. They're very flame resistant, but they don't have good moisture management. They're clammy and hot. And if you're running around in the Middle East, that's not good. That's great if you're, you know, on a plane, or you're sitting in an air-conditioned vehicle and you might get hit by an IED. Mm-hmm. That's a place to use that fabric. But you want something comfortable and even something that looks kind of cool, like that you're going to feel, okay, morale is important. And a uniform is always going to be part of morale.
And there was some question about, obviously, now women serving in the military, kind of what, you know, what that uniform looks like when you've got two right. different kinds of bodies.
The ACU, the Army Combat Uniform, was a kind of a designed to be one pattern fits all, but it didn't fit women. It was either going to be too tight in the hips or too big in the shoulders, and so now there's an alternate version of it. And some of the men who are smaller stature are like, I want this one, you know. They don't call it the female one, they call it the alternate ACU. So.
You tell a story about the multiple patterns for camouflage while we're talking on fabrics, and I do want to talk about buttons and zippers, but this I guess attempt to come up with some kind of camouflage that would work.
An effort to create a universal pattern that would work, you know, woodland, urban, desert, because there were different patterns, and it'd just be simpler and more cost efficient to have one pattern. So there were 13 patterns that were being evaluated at NATIC as a camouflage research facility, which is classified. I was not allowed in there. this was so. Then they had these patterns they'd come up with, and those were sent over seas to be tested in the field, but before all of that feedback could be assimilated and the decision could be made, someone in a high level said, "It's going to be this one. I like this one." So that was the poor people at NATIC, you know,
said, okay,
hate that
yes,
story.
Sir.
They're like, God, not that again, not the camouflage story again. Anyway, and it didn't work, and it wasn't safe, and it's been replaced. So, yeah.
That's Mary Roach, and she's got a new book. It's called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. She's also written a bunch of other books, Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, is it?
Mm-hmm.
In the Void. And Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Particularly interested in hearing from people who are in the military or who have served in the military and can probably speak to what we're talking about from a very personal experience. There are 22 pages on buttons in the military.
Yes, the U.S. government button specifications are quite lengthy, and a button has to withstand. I mean, it's kind of a medieval description of, you know, the shank must be, you know, must not pull on it until it separates from the body, and the, you know, dipping it in water and boiling it, and so the buttons, they're very sturdy buttons. They're very sturdy buttons.
This is part of the chapter that looks at why zippers and even Velcro can be a problem if you're a sniper.
So, well, yeah, when I was at NATIC, I visited the design studio, and there's a woman there, Annette Lafleur, who had designed a top for a base suit for a sniper, and the top was quite kind of fashion forward with a side closure. And I was like, I commented on that, sort of a sleek and fashionable look. And she said, well, it's actually practical, because if you had a closure right down the front and if you're a sniper, you're lying on your belly for a long period of time, buttons or a zipper would be uncomfortable. So, and I said, well, what about Velcro? She said, Velcro is loud. You open it up, it goes. So that if stealth is part of your job description, that's a problem. There's Velcro is the generic is hook and closure. There's a hook and closure task force that is part of the clothing subcommittee. Anyway,
this is why we have a $500 billion military budget.
Yeah. So anyway, so that you don't. I never occurred to me to think about how would you design a uniform. And so the designers. I mean, she has a fashion background. She was, comes from she was a swimwear designer. This another woman in her lab had been worked at Priscilla of Boston, which was high end wedding dresses. And you know these are it's similar. You know, kind of makes sense in a way in that they're specialty fabrics. Mm-hmm. And they're designed for a very specific function, and they have to be anyway. It was interesting to, you know, to see yeah. how they combine design with the realities of what the uniform has to do. And you know, she said we're really more engineers than designers.
Well, speaking of realities, a section about making vehicles bomb resistant, things protecting vehicles from things like IEDs. And I certainly remember, and it still makes me so angry when I think about it, early on in the Iraq War, when then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld goes over to talk to the troops there, and they complain bitterly about the fact that they are there using vehicles that don't have body armor. That they are
some,
really
right. Some with canvas doors.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And their sort of complaint about, you know, how can you send us to war with this kind of equipment? And he kind of made some offhand remark about, well, you just, you know, you go to the war with the stuff that you've got. But you say something interesting, which is that we tend to use gear from the last mm-hmm. war, mm-hmm. which sort mm-hmm. of makes sense when you think about it.
Sure, you have uniforms and equipment and vehicles that were created for the last conflict, which may have happened in a completely different right. weather environment, and the threats change depending on who the enemy is and what they are able to get their hands on or put together. So, even some of the things that you could plate a vehicle with were great for rifle fire, but not an RPG.
Yes.
And so then they looked at, okay, there's this stuff called reactive armor where if it's hit, it explodes, it kind of negates the explosion of the RPG. Great, except that with urban warfare, there are pedestrians and even your own soldiers who may be walking around the vehicle. So that's not so good. So no. Trying to just figure out, you know, based on the environment and the threat, what do we do to this vehicle? And you'd think, well, I'll just armor it up, just up armor it. Well, you can only make it so much heavier before the engine is starting to strain, the brakes are burning out, or you're even getting to the point where you're collapsing the roadways and or it's going to be impossible to ship it on a plane because it's so heavy. So many different factors yeah. to incorporate in your thinking of how do you keep people safe inside a vehicle that other people are trying to blow up.
Well, especially with things like IEDs that are sort of right. buried in the road. So it's coming up from underneath
right.
as opposed to right. other parts of the vehicle.
Right, right. Yeah, coming up from below. Yeah, and because the, you know, the situation with the Humvee was not an ideal vehicle. So yeah. The Pentagon was looking at mine-resistant armored vehicles and needed to evaluate them. They were getting prototypes from different contractors and needed to evaluate them. And a crash test dummy is designed for an automotive crash, which is either a head-on or a side impact. So the force is not coming up from below, and the dummy wasn't designed. If you look side by side at a cadaver and automotive crash test dummy and you set off a blast underneath a platform, There's very little over, like the head moves in the opposite direction. There's very little motion in the arms of the dummy. There's no the feet, the ankles don't flex the way they would need to because there's a tremendous impact to the feet. If it's because the old vehicles were a flat chassis, so you just they'd slam into the soldiers' mm-hmm. feet, and then
hit their head sometimes.
Right, and the seat that they're sitting on would also the energy would come up to the pelvis and the spine. A lot of back injuries. Mm. So, you know, looking at different ways to, they ended up making the seat is not bolted to the floor. The floor is in a V shape. This chassis is V or double V, so that deflects some of the energy. Right. And now, of course, there's bigger shaped charges that are coming up from below, actually breaking through into the interior of the vehicle. So it's constantly morphing, and the government and any large organization that's doing scientific work, it's a slow plodding scenario, and it doesn't respond quickly to the changing threats, and so that's a constant frustration for sure. people trying to keep personnel safe.
Let me get Joel from Westchester to join our conversation. Joel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Mary,
thank you for the book. I actually heard you last weekend with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and I wanted to ask you about, you had spoken about the way they changed some movie sets over into lifelike combat situations for medics. And I'm a former Navy corpsman. And I remember one of the hardest things to figure out was how to train yourself to withstand all the stress of combat and still do your job as a medic, which requires a lot of concentration. It was just very interesting. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Joel, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a former movie studio out. It's near Camp Pendleton, and it's called Strategic Operations, and it's a guy who used to do action films, and at a certain point took his talent for chaos and military situations and explosions and gore, and created these hyper-realistic scenarios for to train Navy corpsmen who are, as you said, the medics for the Marine Corps, and also Army medics. And the idea behind it, the principle behind it, is stress inoculation. In other words, if you could create something realistic enough here and give someone sort of a dose of that, it might help them in an actual real situation. Because, you know, the fight or flight response, that's great for fighting or fleeing. But if what you need to do is, you know, do a needle decompression of someone's chest or cut an airway or operate equipment that, you know, you need to have fine motor skills and you need all your mental facilities, and the fight or flight response doesn't help with that. So, how do you prepare someone for that? And so the scenarios, I mean, I was there and I knew that it was fake, obviously. But I mean, they go to the extremes of they had an amputee actor and he had a sleeve over his stump and he had a backpack with stage blood that was pumping, and he had a remote control so that depending on how the corpsman trainee was doing, the bleeding would stop or he would bleed out and die. Mm. And it, you know, there's loud noise. They were playing all kinds. Anyway, it seemed, you know, I don't know if it can't hurt. Hopefully helps.
Hopefully helps. Mary Roach, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Joel, thanks for giving us a call. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. 1-888-477-9499. The number to call to join our conversation. Much more after this very short break, including a section on maggots. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Mary Roach. She's written a bunch of books, including Gulp, Packing for Mars, Bonk, Spook, Stiff, and a new one called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Particularly interested in hearing, like Joel, from folks in our audience who have served in the military. Maggots. And I certainly have seen maggots. You take a walk in the woods, sometimes you'll see a dead carcass of an animal somewhere, and there are the maggots sort of roiling all over this carcass. And it is scary and kind of nauseating. But maggots, this is an important part of understanding people getting injuries in war and what, I guess, nature can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maggots, there's a maggot therapy, which is specifically, it's debridement. The maggots in a wound are eating dead. They specifically like to dine on dead tissue. And that serves a really important function in promoting healing of a wound. And this was discovered primarily by World War One, by a French expeditionary, Dr. William Baer. And these two patients came in who'd been lying in the woods for 7 days. And they came in and they had these large wounds that were infested, and of course everyone's horrified. They cleaned them out, and Bear noticed this amazing healthy pink tissue that was growing in. Wow. And noticed it happening enough that he thought, something's going on here. The maggots, you'd think that they would cause infection. They seem to be preventing not only debridement but preventing infection. And he was the first to try this among civilians, and it worked. And they weren't getting infections, and the wounds were healing, including really stubborn wounds. And nowadays, maggot therapy is used primarily on diabetics with foot ulcers that are not healing, because the maggots will go, and they're very effective, and they're actually an FDA-approved medical device.
I read that. That's
In the book, I have the Medicare reimbursement code for maggots. You have to be careful because there's a lot of care that has to go into it, and you don't want to leave them in too long, because if they leave the wound and want to go pupate and become flies, now you have flies in your hospital setting, and that's not good. So they have to be changed, and you have to find personnel who will deal with that. So the average hospital is a little like, not only because of the gross out factor, but because you definitely don't want flies in a hospital spreading germs. So,
well, you said during the break that if you take one little maggot and put it on your finger, it's kind of cute.
Yeah, the maggots in that size, and they're about a day old and about a couple centimeters, they're like, they look like a cupcake sprinkle. That's the size they are, and they kind of inch along, and they're white, and it's only when they're in the, you know, this mass kind of pulsating feeding machine, because that's what they do. They just eat, and they're eating. It's good, the stuff that they're eating. You want them to be eating that, but if that was your wound, I mean, it is hard to imagine having that happen, but it's also, you have to keep in mind, if you have this wound that doesn't heal, and the alternative is possibly even amputation,
right,
maggots are your friend, and you welcome the maggots, I think.
Let me get Carl from, looks like Burlington, New Jersey. Hi, Carl. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How
Hi
you doing?
Hi.
Sure.
You guys were talking earlier about the situation in Iraq.
Yes.
I happen to be a veteran of convoys in Iraq. I was actually stationed at Camp Buring when Secretary Rumsfeld made that disgraceful speech.
Oh, really?
I wasn't there that day because I was in Arifjan, Kuwait, rounding up scrap metal to make our own armor for the vehicles with. We called it hillbilly armor.
Mm.
And the vehicles looked Frankensteinian. It was bizarre. The upshot is I ended up doing over 100 convoys in an unarmored vehicle, one of which I was blown up in.
Oh, geez, Carl. I'm so sorry.
So, first of all, I want to thank you for raising this issue. Second of all, when you talk about going to the war with the stuff that's left over from the previous war, I can't stress enough how important it is that we change that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know where we're fighting next, and there needs to be research and development that will protect our troops. Right now, it seems like we need protection from the people that are sending us more than we need protection from anything else.
Well, Carl,
I just really want to thank you for raising this topic.
Well, Carl, I thank you for what you did for all of us in Iraq, and certainly for calling into the show. Mary?
Yes. Yeah, no, my sentiments. Yeah, thank you. And thank you for adding that, because I remember hearing someone talk about, at a certain point there were some fixes made, but then the gunner on top was exposed, and they were taking sandbags in an effort to protect themselves, and then the explosion would go off, and they would basically sandblast the person because the sandbag would blow apart. But just trying to do it.
At one point, there were actually police departments back home that were actually sending us their used vests line the insides of our vehicles with.
Yeah,
and sandbags in the floor and scrap metal in the door frames, whatever we could do. It was nuts. It was. Meanwhile, at Fort Dix, there were armored vehicles rolling around.
Yeah. Well, Carl, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I think it really underscores something, because on the one hand, Mary, you're talking to people, serious people who are dedicating their lives to figuring out how to make the best kind of uniform material, or even discovering the use of maggots and things like that. And then we hear from Carl the sort of willy-nilly nature of what happened.
Yeah, and just the incredibly lumbering pace of approval and paperwork. And
even the lack of seriousness, if you know what I mean. I mean, compared to the people that you interviewed that were really serious about what they were doing.
Right, yeah.
Carl, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling into Radio Times. This is a really weird segue, but I wanted to ask you, how does a maggot work?
Well, it's eating is basically what it's doing, and its preference is dead tissue. So that's how it does the debridement. And it seems to be excreting something antibacterial. There's a couple different papers on what exactly is going on in terms of preventing infection. I'm not entirely clear the mechanism, but that's how they do what they do, and it's and
out
they,
the
and
other
they
end,
do,
right?
Yeah, and they when they're feeding, they're this is just what they do. They just feed and they prepare for when they're going to go and turn into pupate and become a fly. So they're just eating. They actually dive in head first. They immerse themselves head first and breathe through their butt. They have a spiracles. Is how they breathe, and so Among the many unappealing qualities of a maggot, it breathes through its butt.
Let me get Ed from Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're on the air, Ed. Go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. I'm calling in because I heard about the military uniform segment, and I was very impressed with how much detail the author collected. I served in the Army National Guard from about 2004, and I was actually in when they made the transition from the BDU, which was like very foresty, to the ACU. And there were a lot of like minutia and details that they were really trying to make a very good uniform, and it was a very expensive process. Little things like when they found out that Velcros were a little too loud, mm-hmm. so buttons were preferred. How black, which was a very dominant, I wouldn't say a dominant color, but it was a very strong color in the BDU, black did not exist in the environments that we were now fighting.
Oh, wow.
So they had to kind of switch that out. But yeah, I'm very impressed at how much really goes in to make a functioning uniform mm-hmm. For different environments. Thank you for that segment.
Thanks for the call to Radio
yeah,
Times.
Yeah, Mary, thank ahead. You. Yeah. And even with all the thinking that goes into it, you know, you put it out in the field, and invariably you get feedback. Like there was a gear harness that had been developed that didn't have a quick opening, and there was a case of someone falling into water and not being able to open the gear vest quickly and get it off.
Wow.
So back to the drawing board, needed a quick release function that was also something going on in the design lab. So yeah, even when you what if'd the whole scenario. Something will come back that you hadn't thought about, and you've got to kind of go back to the beginning.
Ed, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's talk about stench soup. And we began by talking about the sort of hot chili peppers being used as a kind of a weapon, the idea of something just really absolutely disgusting
a non-lethal weapon. The Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate in the 90s commissioned Pam Dalton, who's here in Philadelphia, Monell Chemical Senses Center, to come up with a universally loathed, truly revolting smell. The idea being to clear terrain, to disperse a mob. Instead of tear gas, it's an alternative to, say, tear gas or flashbang bombs or those right. things that go off. And so she did that, and it was interesting the complexity of it, what they came up with, this item code. They started with what was tested to be the most universally loathed smell, which is called U.S. government standard bathroom malodor. They started yes. with that, which different populations all around the world have agreed, this is revolting, we hate it, it's scary, we don't want to be around it. But then they added, and this was the beauty of it, that they added a kind of a fruity, sweet top note. So that, because when you first go to smell an unknown substance, you take a tentative whiff. And so the top note is kind of sweet, and then it encourages you to inhale deeply. And then on the keeper inhale, this is a term I learned from Pam, on the keeper inhale, you get this whiff of this horrible, just revolting smell. So anyway, that is stench soup. And stench soup, I don't know what the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate did with stench soup. I mean, Pam's job was to create it, test it, the testing. She has some stories about the testing, but that are in the book. But anyway, it's an interesting application of.
Well, we should say that Mary Roach has some stench soup in her closet.
They sent me a sample, it's in a bottle, double bagged, in a box that I haven't had the courage to open.
And this universally condemned smell, all right, while we're on the topic, so it's vomit, sewage, burnt hair, and bathroom.
Well, those were the different odors that they took around to different cultures and tested to see, you know, which one does everyone, because some of them, like for example, butyric acid may, depending on context, smell like Parmesan cheese or vomit, smelly feet. I forget. Anyway, the universal one was the U.S. government standard bathroom malodor, which is a compound that was created for testing latrine deodorizers. So they needed something really vile that approximated a really old open field latrine. It was a military project. They were looking to come up with a deodorant. So this is what they came up with. So that was that got the highest score. And then they added the sweet kind of floral overtones.
And are you going to, you know, pass this on to the next generation of roaches when you move on?
I was going to bring it with me on tour, but I thought there might be a problem going to TSA. I'm like, don't open that. Don't open that. It's a non-lethal weapon. And then they're going to go, yep, it's come with us. And then they're going to really regret opening it up.
You donated some stress smell to the Monell?
If you go to Monell, they're gonna get something from you. Yeah, I donated some stress underarm odor to them for some project. I'm not sure what, but they stressed me out by having me count backwards from 200 by 13, and
oh my goodness,
telling me, and every time I got it wrong, I had to start over again, and then was filming it and threatening to put it on YouTube.
That would be an anger smell, I would think. Let me get Vic from, looks like Phoenixville, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Vic. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In the movie Gladiator, there's a scene where Russell Crowe has an injury, and he's being tended to by an African tribesman using maggot therapy. And I'm just curious as to whether this was incorporated into the movie or whether maggot therapy goes way back before World War One.
I think it does.
Your comment off the air.
Sorry to cut you off. Yes, there was a paper on maggot therapy, and there was in the historical section there were references to it being used going way back. I mean, William Baer was the first to medicalize it in a way. Yeah. Well, obviously, if they were using it on gladiators, it sounds like. I mean, I'm not. I don't know. You don't know. It came and went. There'd be little pockets of it was discovered here and there throughout history and around the world. There were folks who had noticed it as well. So it wasn't entirely William Baer's discovery, but in Western medicine, he kind of put it on the map as a documenting in like 69 patients. That was the first paper on it. So, yeah, you are absolutely right. It had been noticed before.
Vic, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here, but I do want to talk about the fact that you write that the VA spends something like $1 billion a year on hearing loss. And I guess when you think about it, there's the sounds of war, but also the sound of what it is to shoot a gun right next to your ear. It's two things.
It's rifles and explosions, where just one brief, less than a second exposure can cause damage. But also, being in an armored personnel carrier or a helicopter, that's beyond a safe level. So if you're and if you're exposed for hours at a time, then you know because it's not just how loud it is; it's also how long you're exposed to it. So both of those things together. And the other problem is, you can put in hearing foamies, little foam earplugs, or you can put on ear cuffs, but now you've lost your situational awareness. Now you can't really hear a human voice very well. You may miss a sound that may end up being really important. And the feeling is I'd rather save my life than save my hearing. So the effort has been to come up with something called TCAPs, which is being used in some areas of the military. It's not as widely available, but anyway, it's kind of cool headset that it lessens the loud noises and amplifies the human voice. I mean, the quiet ones, which is kind of cool.
Two tweets here. Thanks to @MaryRoach. Next time I get a cut, I'm using maggots instead of bandages. A tweet from Samantha. I'm never eating sprinkles again. # maggot therapy. Mary Roach, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You bet. Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, Mary Roach, our guest. The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And she continues, and perhaps there is a genre now, the Mary Roach book genre. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.